Christ in Every Word, the weekly podcast of the Concordia Bible Institute housed on the campus of Concordia University, Wisconsin. This is your opportunity every week to read, mark, learn, and take to heart the sacred scriptures with Dr. John Seleska, director of the Concordia Bible Institute, and me, your fellow host and learner, Dr. John Oberdeck. Now, we have been going through the book of Genesis, and we've been doing so in depth. As you know, the title of this podcast is Christ in Every Word, and as we've been going through Genesis, we've been seeing those telltale signs of the promise of a Savior to come. We've seen how that promise has gone from generation to generation, and now as we draw toward the conclusion of the book of Genesis, we're going to again notice how that promise sustains itself through this particular family as it moves forward. So we're in Genesis chapter 47, and right. John, what would you like to do to help introduce us to this chapter and perhaps even review a few things from our last session together?
I'll just review those first eight verses that we talked about last time, where after Jacob and his family, realizing that Joseph is now alive and that the famine was going to last for a number of years, decided to accept the invitation of Joseph to come down to Egypt and to live there where he would provide for them amply during the famine. So they do that, as a matter of fact, and now they find themselves in front of the Pharaoh. Joseph has brought them there together with five of his brothers to introduce them to Pharaoh and, of course, to talk a little bit about where they're going to live in Egypt. It's going to be the land that land of Goshen, which evidently is very fertile. It would be good for their crops. It would separate them from the Egyptians and their gods. And so Joseph realized this, I think, even before they came down and chose it himself for them. So they're in front of Pharaoh and requesting that land, and Pharaoh, of course, gladly accedes to that request by Joseph because he has great love for and respect and admiration for Joseph and what he has done for the entire country. And at that point, then, Pharaoh asks Jacob his age. And Jacob, I think it's about verse 8 or 9, where Jacob then goes into a little bit of his history. He says, the time of my pilgrimage. And I think it's interesting that he uses that, and he uses it again in, I think, the next chapter. But it's an interesting word that we talked a little bit about, but I do want to emphasize again the idea behind it.
The idea behind this word pilgrimage.
Pilgrim,
I know the ESV translates it sojourning.
Sojourner, yeah.
So pilgrim. Sojourner, sojourning, pilgrim.
Mm-hmm. If we could, let me just let me refer to a couple of thoughts. I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but it really deserves some consideration here. The word pilgrim, and maybe... our listeners will remember back in Genesis chapter 14, after Lot had been captured, and one of the escapees goes to Abraham and tells him about the fact that Lot has been taken captive, and Abraham gathers together something like 318 men, but they refer to him as Abraham the Hebrew. Eber is the word, Ivri is the Hebrew word, and it really means a pilgrim. It means one from the other side, or one from beyond, interesting word, or one who passes over. The basic word, I believe, is avar, and it derives from the name that's found in chapter 11 of Genesis, Eber. But it has an interesting kind of etymology, Passover. And so in Exodus... chapter 12, where they celebrate the Passover, we get that idea. They're going to pass over from one land to another, but this is a feast of passing over. And in 1 Corinthians 5, I think it is, verse 7, Christ, our Passover, is sacrificed for us. The one from the other side, or one from beyond, interestingly, because you can apply that to Christ.
Is that at all similar to being a stranger or a
yes.
foreigner?
Yeah,
so
perfect.
Uh-huh.
Perfect. Exactly what it does mean. And in fact, I guess, is it 1 Peter 2 where it says, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, or they considered, Hebrews 11, they considered themselves, Hebrews, pilgrims and strangers and wanderers. Well, all of us are pilgrims in that respect. So it's a very interesting word and a very important word for us to understand, because we're but strangers here. Heaven is our home. We all know the hymn.
Yeah. So when he says the days of the years of my sojourning are 130 years, he's kind of saying the years of my wandering, the years of my passing through. This is all transitory in some sense.
Right.
There's not a whole lot here that's permanent.
It's going from one place to another. So are we. And we really need to apply it to ourselves and to our hearers. We're strangers here, pilgrims, wanderers. Abraham was told, you know, to, quotes, travel from one end of the land to the other and its length and breadth. As a, quotes, wanderer, he was referred to as that. So all of that plays a part in the answer which he gives here. The days of my pilgrimage have been 130 years, but they've been evil days, most of them. He has suffered a lot of affliction and a lot of heartache and hardship in his life, and he said he had not attained unto the age of his forefathers. He's 130 years old, but he doesn't figure to get much older. I mean, he already seems to be feeling his years.
Yeah. Well, he's got a lot of them.
He's got
a lot of them to feel, too.
According to our reckoning, of course, he's got a lot more than we would expect. But then of course, he's... he leaves, and it talks a little bit about Joseph and the way in which he used his wisdom in dealing out the grain that he had gathered over those 7 years of plenty. First of all, I think he took the money from the people for the grain. When they ran out of money, they offered the cattle, and he took their cattle. And when they ran out of cattle, he took the land. And eventually, of course, they didn't have anything left, so they offered themselves as servants.
So by the end of this famine, Pharaoh owns everything.
Everything, and the people,
and
too.
The people themselves. Okay.
And so he makes
the alternative was you don't eat.
Yeah, and they recognized that, as a matter of fact. They said, we know that you saved us our lives, and we're willing to become your servants, that is, the servants of Pharaoh, in order to remain alive. And so it worked out very well. It says that Joseph, in fact, passed a law which required that the people would give of anything that they produced, I assume, for some time into the future, one-fifth all that they would produce later would still belong to Pharaoh. So it would
20% be a constant 20% tax rate.
Right.
Hmm. Okay.
So I'm sure that Pharaoh recognized what he had done. I mean, he owns everything now. He really is the ruler in the land. And obviously, he recognized the wisdom that Joseph had in understanding what was going to happen and how to deal with that. So all that he had experienced in an adverse way, being sold into slavery, being placed in prison when he was innocent, all that stood him in good stead finally in the face of the famine and what to do about it. He learned administrative tasks and all the things that would be necessary. So the Lord had a reason for it all, which he may not have seen. Same with us. We may not always see it, but the Lord does have a reason for what's happening. There are no accidents in God's economy.
So they settle in the land of Egypt and the land of Goshen, and Jacob lives another 17 years,
17 years,
us.
Yeah. He mentions that, of course, at the towards the end, like about 28, verse 28 or so, he mentions that he's been here 17 years together with 130. So that makes him 147, which will be the length of the days of his years, as he says it. And then I think it's the last verse where he mentions again that he will be gathered to his people. That's that little phrase in the Old Testament that I think has very much meaning, because with Abraham, it says that he died and was buried and he was gathered to his people, separate incidents. And that, I think, is the same thing that Jacob meant here. It doesn't mean that he's going to be buried in Machpelah with Abraham and Leah and so forth, but rather that he really is going to go to join the saints in glory. And he expects to do that. I think you could see that the prospect for him seems very heartening. He's ready to do this.
Mm-hmm.
Like with Paul, I have a desire to depart.
Uh-huh.
Well, that takes us to the end of chapter 47, and now the end is in sight for Jacob, and he realizes that, and he becomes ill. He has an illness. And Luther says that old age is in itself an illness. It's interesting, but I recognize what that means. At my age, I know what it means to say that that old age is in itself a disease or a sickness, because it's true that there are so many things that continue to go wrong with the body that eventually you know that the Lord is going to call more strongly as the day approaches.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing. We know that cells replicate themselves, that they replace themselves, and over a certain number of years, you know, just about every cell in the human body winds up being replaced with another cell. But we get to a certain age, and rather than replacing those cells with new, fresh cells, it replaces them with older-looking cells. it's just an interesting question how that biology operates, but aging takes place.
All an effect of the fall, is it not?
Smooth is now wrinkled. And
yes, and that was not one of the things we bargained for when we get old.
No.
Wrinkles weren't part of the bargain, as far as I can tell. I don't recall agreeing to it. And I suppose our listeners who are understanding what we mean didn't agree to it either.
Well, I know another thing that's mentioned about aging in the Old Testament is about whether or not their eyes grow dim.
Yeah.
You wonder, well, cataracts certainly create that difficulty. But then even for most people, you know, the eyes no longer rapidly change their ability to focus.
No.
And so it takes longer, and that's why I've got trifocals.
If you have trifocals, you know, I don't have those. I don't know.
Oh, you should try them, John. Helpful. You get two lines rather than one in front of your glasses.
I'm a slow learner. I don't think I could have done three. Two is hard enough.
Well, you know, originally they tried to have me with those that didn't have the lines, I didn't know where I was looking. That didn't work at all. I had to have lines.
My optometrist told me don't. He said it's really more painful than it's worth. Most people just have, at your age, he said, looking at me, he said, at your age, most people have a lot of difficulty adjusting to them. So I never did try them.
Yeah.
But it's interesting, though, because both Isaac and now Jacob are dim. Their eyes have dimmed, and it's impossible for him here to see Ephraim and Manasseh, whom Joseph is going to bring now toward the end of Jacob's life in chapter 48. So we might as well begin with that and talk a little bit about his getting sick, and then Joseph realizes that the end is near, so he takes the two sons. His two sons, yeah. Ephraim and Manasseh, who were born to him in Egypt. And he realizes now that something will have to be done in terms of their future. Will they remain in Egypt as, quotes, Egyptians, or will they truly be members of the family, and will they be accorded the same advantages as the other sons, not because they aren't born of that seed of Joseph, who is, of course, Jacob's son, but rather because they're in Egypt and that they really weren't afforded the understanding of that land which had been given to Jacob, and that they were really entitled to some place in. So he brings them, and they begin to talk about those two boys, and it's interesting, I think, verse 5 and following, where Jacob calls them his own sons. Those two belong to him, he says. The other children that you might have here, and we don't hear about anymore, but we aren't told that if he did, they simply would not have followed, evidently.
And that's why Ephraim and Manasseh become tribes.
They do.
Mm-hmm. Rather than just, there's no tribe of Joseph.
No. No, Joseph doesn't get a tribe. He gets two. Mm-hmm. He gets, because you have to wonder who gets the firstborn, because it's not going to be Reuben, but it's Joseph of the first Chronicles, chapter 5, verse 1, I think it is, Joseph received the portion of the firstborn, the double portion, and Ephraim and Manasseh, of course, each get a tribe. So that's the double portion that Joseph received. So he really has two tribes, but not one called by his name. Mm-hmm. And we'll get a little bit into why that happened. We know already why, but it will play a part in the quotes, future promises that Jacob makes as he's about to die, and the will for his 12 sons in chapter 49.
Okay, well, we'll cover that in just a moment as we move toward chapter 49. Right now, we're going to take a break and discuss for a moment what's most valuable in higher education. Concordia University, Wisconsin, is located on the shores of Lake Michigan here in Mequon, just north of Milwaukee. And we are an institution committed to excellence in learning. But at the same time, we realize that excellence isn't enough without a sense of vocation. What is vocation? It's a calling. You see, we believe God works through our vocations, our callings, the careers and the roles that we're educated to fulfill. And we do that in order to meet the needs of our neighbor. The mission statement of Concordia puts it this way. Concordia University, Wisconsin is a Lutheran higher education community committed to helping students develop in mind, body, and spirit for service to Christ in the church and the world. You can learn more about the over 60 programs offered at Concordia by visiting www.cuw.edu. And if you are benefiting from our Christ in Every Word podcast, as I'm sure you are, I'd like to encourage you to support this ministry by mentioning it to others and offering your monetary support. There's many interesting programs that we are developing here, not the least of which is our hope to begin within the next 12 months to develop some short online courses for individuals to take and offer them through our Office of Continuing and Distance Education here at Concordia. But of course, that requires some support, and if you'd feel encouraged to do so, we'd appreciate your support of that and other kinds of projects that we have. You can do this by going to our website, www.concordiabible.org. That's one word, concordiabible.org, and click on the contribute page. You'll find several ways in which you can support the message of Christ in Every Word. And now, in just a moment, we'll be back to our topic at hand, which is the last days of Jacob and the blessings that he is about to give to his family. Welcome back to Christ in Every Word. We are in Genesis chapter 48, and now Jacob is claimed both of Joseph's older sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, to be his own, and they become tribes, right, among the tribes of Israel.
Now he's going to bless these two, and there's an interesting occurrence again in this case, as occurred earlier for some others that we're already familiar with and we won't have to rehearse. But it is interesting, as in verse 10, I think it is, that Jacob indicates that he doesn't see very well because he asks, who are these? And he's referring to the two sons perhaps that are standing there. Maybe they're shadowy in his vision, but that he doesn't recognize who they are. And Joseph then has to introduce him, I guess, to his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. And so then, as he confers the blessing, now he's going to bless these sons, that they will, in that blessing, of course, have conferred on them the whole range of blessings that would occur to Joseph and, of course, to his family. And so as he does this, a strange thing occurs. Joseph has the sons, and Manasseh is the firstborn, and Joseph has him at his left hand and Ephraim on his right, but facing Jacob so that Jacob would place his right hand on Manasseh, the firstborn, and his left, of course, then on Ephraim, the second. But interestingly, Jacob does a strange thing. He, in fact, crosses Joseph up and places his right hand on Ephraim, the youngest.
So he crosses his arms,
I guess,
as he puts his hands on.
How to view that, but
yeah, he would have had to, I imagine.
He does that, and of course, then he confers the blessing. And that verse 16 is an interesting verse. As he does this, he refers to the angel who rescued him from all evil. Now, that in the King James, the word angel is capitalized, probably messenger in most of your Bibles. I'm not real sure how it's translated.
ESV says angel.
Angel. Mm-hmm. Well, the King James uses angel. Does it have it capitalized?
No, it doesn't.
Well, it does in the King James. Uh-huh. And I think we need to understand that that's the Malach, the angel of the Lord.
So would this have been the one with whom he wrestled?
I'm sure.
Okay.
This is the angel that blessed him. So I'm sure he has a reference there to Genesis 28, where he wrestled, or 32 also. But the angel that blessed him in chapter 28, when he slept with the rock as his pillow, and then he would be a great nation, is how he indicates here, that that angel had blessed him and conferred on him the understanding that he would be a great nation, and that that land where he was, Luz, or Bethel, that that would be his property. And so he makes reference to that here, so that I'm sure that not only Joseph, who may have heard it earlier in his life, but that the two sons could hear it too, Ephraim and Manasseh, the angel that rescued me from all evil, sin, death, hell, Satan. That's got to be a reference to, quotes, the second person of the Trinity, the Malach Yahweh, the angel of the Lord, or Christ himself. And he's the one who confers the blessing. I'm convinced of that. And then, of course, Joseph notices, I believe, verse 17, notices that he's got this mixed up, that he's crossed the hands and he's got the wrong hand on the wrong guy. And so he tries to correct it, and then Jacob says, no, my son, this is correct. Manasseh is going to be great, but Ephraim is going to be greater. It's interesting. You don't know what kind of thoughts went through the minds of those two young men, but it's interesting that we have that kind of crossover often up to this point already in conferring the blessing to younger, often somehow, it replaces the elder.
Yeah. Isaac's two sons, yeah. Okay, Jacob supplants Esau.
It's mm-hmm. interesting, but it is God's way, the unexpected. And then, of course, Jacob makes mention of the fact that he's about to die to be gathered to his people. And so if you look at verse 21 and 22 there at the end of the chapter, I'm not sure of the verses, but he's going to die, of course, and he wants to be buried with his fathers, and he's again going to at the final moment when it happens. I'll just jump to that now because we have a number of references to his death, and before his death, he's going to bless the young men. But he does the same thing that Abraham did with his servant when he sent the servant to find a wife for Isaac. Put your hand under my thigh and make this pledge or oath. Now, what does that mean is the question, and I'm not real sure how to explain it except to suggest that this is sort of the location of the loins, or the seed is in the loins, and actually future generations and the Messiah himself would be involved in this, I am convinced. But you recall the passage in in Hebrews chapter 11, where it says that Levi paid a tithe to Melchizedek. Even before he was in the loins, it says, of Abraham when he paid a tithe, so that it says in effect that Levi paid the tenth. Now, in the human sense, in the temporal sense, the Levites receive the tenth, but he paid a tenth. This is what the argument there is. But it's interesting that he is seen as already alive from God's perspective, even though he's not born.
So something here is going on with the generations,
yes.
That all the generations are contained in the first one.
Yeah, I'm sure of that. But it is an interesting way of making an oath. But it confirms the oath to the point of we're doing this on the basis of a promise that God has made of a Messiah to come to rescue all humankind, and we're the bearers.
And how many generations is it going to be before that Messiah arrives? They don't know at this point.
No, but he's going to go through the whole, he's going to look at their whole history of all these, and one of them is going to be the chosen one from whom this Messiah is going to come. That's chapter 49.
And when we look at 49, there is a blessing given to each of the sons. Some of them aren't so much of a blessing.
Well, okay, we'll say blessing, but he is going to speak a word to each of them.
Well, maybe it's
not a real kind word.
Okay,
but he starts out.
My last words to you, and
But it's interesting. He's looking into the future. He's going to tell the future. And I don't know if anyone has ever checked to see how closely this resembles the history of those tribes. I think you could probably do it. I could give you a few. We may do that as we go through. But first of all, he talks about Reuben, the firstborn, my strength and my might. He's supposed to be the one steadfast and unmovable, but in fact, he's unstable as water. And he's not really going to receive the portion of the firstborn because he went up to his father's bed and defiled it. And that's that act in chapter 34 where he took Bilhah, one of the father's father's handmaids, and had intercourse with her. And, of course, Jacob heard about it, it says, and we know that he responded to that in no uncertain terms. And he's doing so here, saying, this has not been forgotten.
You will not have preeminence.
Yeah, you won't have preeminence. Yep. Now, he's, I mean, that's not a kind word. but then they're all lined up, I assume, because he has called them together. The next ones are Simeon and Levi. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitation. And then he says this interesting thing, I think verse 6, oh, my soul, don't, this is how it says it in the King James, don't come into their counsel. And the idea, I think, and I don't know how that translates it, is that I did not have anything to do with what they did. They're murderers, really, that they...
That was the Shechemites.
Yeah,
that
the Shechemites.
Yeah.
And then it says that they're cruel also. Now, again, I don't know if it says that they broke down a wall, but it really does seem to mean Shon means they really cobbled, I think, an ox.
Well, the word that's used here is hamstrung.
Hamstrung.
For in their anger they killed men, and in their willfulness they hamstrung oxen.
It's like they were cruel to animals, even. I mean,
not only to people, but just
mean-spirited young men. Mm-hmm. I'll divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. He's not real happy with these two at all.
Yeah.
And so we know that's true with Levi. He calls them brethren. And the idea is that, of course, they're of the same mentality. And they can't really live together because they'd be too much of a threat, I think, to the others and to anyone else in their neighborhood. So I'll divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Now, you can imagine, after that, he has just excoriated Reuben and Simeon and Levi with a withering...
That's why these aren't blessings from Jacob.
With a withering attack. And now you can imagine Judah. He's standing there listening to all this. Sort of like, I don't know, you have a brother, and you know the both of you did something wrong, and your father is really giving it to the first one, but he's saying to the second one, now you just wait there until you get it. Your turn will still come.
And they're all lined up. All these sons are lined up.
And Judah is thinking, oh, brother. He's the one who had gone down, took a Canaanite wife, and then he had intercourse with his own daughter-in-law. You can imagine what he's thinking. Well, I'm really going to get it, and just don't hit me so hard. And then this huge surprise where Jacob, in fact, blesses him with a blessing that I'm sure was totally unexpected in Judah's case. Because this verse 9 is the chief verse there. First of all, of course, he talks about how this man is going to be—he's going to be revered, really. And then the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until now Shiloh comes, and unto him shall the gathering of the people be. And if you look further on, you'll see that he'll tie his donkey. And his colt to vines, different kinds of vines, and wine is going to be so plentiful in a land where water is scarce that they'll be able to wash their clothes in it. I mean, there's going to be great abundance, and all of it flowing from Judah. Now, until Shiloh comes, Shalom. Or we can think of Shiloach, you know, sent, the one sent comes. And one of the Targums, now I think it's Jonathan, but I'm not real sure, translates it like this, until Messiah comes, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, until Messiah comes. Now, that's one of the Jewish paraphrases, and very early, and it's interesting because it suggests that the Jews understood this as clearly referring to the Messiah. And it's a remarkable verse because Shalom, Shiloach, it reminds us of John chapter 9, where go wash in the pool of Shalom, the blind man, the man who was born blind, whom Jesus healed. He put the spittle on the clay and then on the man's eyes. Go wash in the pool of Shalom, Shiloach. The one who sent me healed me, I guess you could say, would be the confession of that blind man. And we could all say the same thing. The one who sent us healed us. But the sending forth, the one sent forth, and as the Father hath sent me, you know, or this is life eternal, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ, whom you have sent.
So this is so tied into the promise. Oh. Judah receives the promise. The scepter will not depart from him.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the ESV has, rather than Messiah or Shiloh, says until tribute comes.
Tribute?
Yeah. Which is, it's a... That's rather odd.
A translation.
Yeah.
That's the ESV?
Yeah. The scepter tribute. Shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until tribute comes to him, tribute. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples.
Well, that is interesting.
Well, the ruler's staff, and maybe the tribute there is again speaking of the tribute that's going to come to him, the Messiah.
Now, I think that if you're a Jew trying to explain this, because they do believe it's messianic, but they have a hard time trying to explain it until Shiloh come. The scepter shall not depart from Judah. He'll receive the spiritual promise until Shiloh comes, Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
Not afterwards. Now think about that. It's been true for 2,000 years afterwards. The other sons will carry with them the temporal blessing. The Jews still exist.
Yeah.
But that promise is the spiritual promise now rests somewhere else. Because with the Jews themselves, they have refused to accept that one. And so they have a difficult time trying to explain how this can be true, and yet that they retain their animosity over against this Messiah who has made his appearance and whom they have not accepted.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, I don't think we're going to make it through the rest
close.
Of these sons. We're not going to make it today, though. We're out of time.
We're close.
We're close, but we will need at least one more session to take us through to the end of the book.
I think it's good because we can end that. It won't take us too long, I don't think, to get through the rest of this and chapter 50. And then that will be a good, very good lead-in into the first chapter of Exodus because it'll take us right to that point. 400 years will have passed, and we'll set the stage for that.
All right.
So it's really not bad.
We'll do that in our next podcast. So I invite you to join us at that time. And until we are able to be together again, I want to encourage you to tell your family and friends about Christ in Every Word. Invite them also to listen as we dive further into Scripture and in it see the imprint of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ every place we look. God's blessings be yours.